When you think about the perfect place to set a novel, Florida has got to be at the top of the list. What recent fiction is telling people about our state? This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. A state that has places like Little Havana, Key West to Disney World and the Redneck Riviera is just begging to be written about in fiction. We're talking about the way Florida has been depicted in recent years. What can fiction capture that other types of writing and reporting cannot? Here in the studio with me to talk about this, Drs. Julie Armstrong and Thomas Halleck, English professors at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg, and Colette Bancroft, the Tampa Bay Times book editor. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So let's kick this off with Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff. This was a finalist, fiction finalist for the 2015 National Book Award, very favorably reviewed by critics. It's a complex portrait of a marriage between the characters Mathilde and Lotto. And Lotto is raised on a remote property in Central Florida where his father owns a water bottling plant. And some of the most affecting and poetic passages in that book are those that are set in Florida. Although they really just make up a very small part of the book, at least for this reader, they were some of the most affecting. So, Colette, you reviewed that book very favorably.
I did.
So how did Groff do you think, when it came to depicting Florida?
I think she made a really interesting use of it. She lives in Gainesville, although she's not a Floridian originally. She's from New York, but she's lived in Gainesville for 10 or 12 years now. And I liked the way in the book that she used Florida to create this sort of fairy tale, mythic element that structures the book in a lot of ways. And Lotto's childhood is that kind of fairy tale story. His nickname sort of suggests the Florida Lottery. And, you know, he's a winner in a lot of ways. But his real name is Lancelot, which sort of tips you off that he's a mythic character.
And
but
his father's name
is Gawain.
Gawain.
Yeah. And his mother, to give it a real Florida punch, is both a wiki-watchy mermaid and a Disney princess. Former. She's not actively doing those things. And Lotto is born during a hurricane. So he's a fairy tale version of Florida man. And she uses the state's bizarre elements and its natural elements, because Gawain, as you say, has made a fortune by selling spring water from family property. I think there's a line in the book about, you know, selling the state's
birthright.
Birthright, yeah.
Yes.
Back to its rightful owners.
That was interesting.
Yeah. So there's that element of the Florida of flimflam artist, all of those things.
Julie.
Yes. I tend to agree with what Colette said, because there's certain, when we teach Florida literature, there's a certain pattern of themes or tropes that we tend to run across. And, Florida as the paradise or the anti-paradise, Florida as the grotesque, Florida as this setting for coming of age, or especially coming of age sexually, mm-hmm. and Florida as a place of travel, migration, and exile. And you see, I think, all of those in this book.
In Fates and Furies.
Yes, it captures all of those. And especially, and I agree with you that the first part of that is written so evocatively about Florida. And in the other parts where Lotto and his wife Matilde are in New York, it could have been any place.
So much more mundane. They're living in a basement apartment. They're struggling to make their rent.
They could have been starving artists in London or Paris, or she could have plopped them down anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was reading the first part of the book, even before she identified the setting, I could have placed it. I mm-hmm. knew before she said, this is in the spring section of Florida, somewhere between Blue Springs and Ocala. I knew it from the way she described it very clearly. She had quite a bit of affection for it.
We talked about the fact that she was a mermaid, and I wanted to read this one passage. And she's at Wikiwachi, and it says, "The paradox of being a mermaid, the lazier she looks, the harder the mermaid works. Antoinette smiled languorously and dazzled. Manatees brushed her. Bluegills nibbled at her hair. But the water was a chilly 74 degrees, the current strong, the calibration of air in the lungs exact to regulate buoyancy or sinking. The tunnel the mermaid swam down to reach the theater was black and long and sometimes caught their hair and held them there by the scalp. She couldn't see the audience but felt the weight of their eyes through the glass." That's a great way of describing Wikiwachi, I thought.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I think she must have interviewed some mermaids, too, to get that kind of detail about the tunnel and their hair getting...
Tom, you specialize a lot in environmental writing or nature writing about Florida, right? I mean, how do you think Lauren Groff got the details in this book?
Oh, absolutely. It's much more visceral and real because she was living in the state. It was closer. There was that immediacy. And then there is something about the springs that lead themselves to that specific exact representation, that exact portrayal, because they are so singular. They are so. They don't exist really anywhere else. And so they lend themselves to that precision and beauty and rapture. There's a long tradition of writing about springs in Florida. You know, going back to William Bartram, I'm actually an early Americanist by trade, but going back to William Bartram and looking into these vats or boils of ether, seeing the fish at various levels and envisioning it as a kind of peaceable kingdom at the time, that the springs have always been a window into not only the natural world, but in the world as we want to see it.
And I guess that's what I kind of like about these more recent books is that we've had a lot of satire. I mean, Florida's ripe for satire, and we've had a lot of that. I mean, there's people like Hyacinth are brilliant. These really show Florida as a kind of more of an Eden. And another thing I wanted to talk about with this book, and we're going to get into with the Yonelossi Ride at Camp for Girls also, is this idea of the characters falling from grace. The characters in these books, after they do something bad or that the adults consider bad, that's when they get sent away from Florida. Mm-hmm. Julie.
Yes, I wanted to pick up on something that you had said before. And I don't necessarily think that it's about, you know, what these landscapes, how they speak to people inside Florida. I think it's about how they speak to the characters. And, you know, this fall from grace is really, it's how this landscape speaks to Lotto, and that fall from grace is really what happens to him. It's a paradise, but it's a paradise lost. And this landscape is what this beautiful landscape into which he's born, this fairy tale landscape, is what he loses when he elopes. Well, when his father dies, and then later when he elopes and he's essentially cast out of the womb when his mother cuts him off. And it is the paradise into which he's born, the paradise he loses, and without giving away too much of the plot, the paradise to which he returns when he dies.
Yes, that is a great scene of the book. I think it's interesting that when Lotto is dying, you're not really sure what's happening at first, but he's back in his mother's house, and he's lived in New York City all of his life after he's 15, but this is where he goes back to. And it's a very evocative scene about being on the beach and on the dunes and in
Florida.
Yeah,
he's been gone at about 30 years, I think, at that point, because he left when he was a teenager and he dies in his 40s. You're not sure what exactly has happened, but you realize that he has died and I guess gone back there at the point of death, and he's recalling his house, and it's
in a fantastical way.
Yes, very dreamlike way. Yes.
Yeah, you kind of understand what's happening, I guess, when his mother rises up through the swimming pool that's like a swamp that's filled with leaves and it's dark water, and she's like a mermaid again. Mm-hmm. So this was that scene that we're talking about. All the while outside, the sun was setting, shadows creeping out of the sea on swift amphibian feet and moving toward the Gulf. Over the intracoastal waterway, the St. John's River, the cold springs and gated swamps, the fountains dyed turquoise and the sad, cheap developments half foreclosed upon. Over the mangroves, over the manatees, over the clams in their beds, one by one closing their hard little lips like a choir at the end of a song. There the shadows dove deeper into the Gulf, rolled into their underwater doubled darkness toward Texas.
It is important to acknowledge that there's something dangerous in this use of the of paradise to define Florida, in this use of the Eden, in this idea of the pastoral, which is the classic literary term. And the pastoral is classic for excluding as much as it includes. The pastoral is always taking us back to a simpler past, and so we ignore or overlook, and we get a mulligan past some of the really uglier chapters in Florida history. It also skews our sense of literature. And so when we ask who is a Florida author, we say Zora Neale Hurston, but not James Weldon Johnson, because Zora Neale Hurston is very much rooted in the land, rooted in the natural beauty of Florida, whereas Johnson is much more of an urbane and metropolitan figure. The problem is when we focus on the pastoral, we really do skew Florida's literary history towards the central part of the state, towards a much more white vision of our literary history. And so I always, when we do get into the pastoral as being the paradise being the defining metaphor or trope or landscape of Florida literature, a red flag comes up for me.
Okay, so and you're talking almost politically about what you think should be.
No, I'm talking about aesthetically. I'm talking about what we recognize as Florida literature and which authors we choose to include and which authors we don't include. When people say, what is Florida literature? People always want to talk about The Land Remembered. They want to talk about Marjorie Kinnon Rollins. We're mm-hmm. always going to these sort of, we're always going to agrarian, rural, natural authors in the natural landscape. We're never really looking at Florida as a setting for travel. We're never looking at Florida as a site for immigration, as authors from outside imagining Florida. But that's really been something from the very, very beginning. We really narrow our compass. We really narrow our readers. We narrow our list of what counts as Florida literature when we focus too much on the idyllic and on the pastoral.
Well, I'm just looking at these books because they were bestseller. You know, these are books that a lot of people read and won awards and things like that.
And these are this is the go-to story of Florida that gets told again and again and again.
Colette.
Again, I would cite, I'll cite two things. There's a lot of recent Florida literature that does do some of the things that you're talking about. I would mention Patricia Engel's recent book, The Veins of the Ocean, set in Miami, that is about immigrants in Florida, and the other writers that deal with those kinds of issues that don't paint Florida as a paradise but deal with those very urban contemporary issues, again, not just environmental but also some of the racial and cultural issues, are those crime writers.
Mm-hmm. I think if the writing is good enough, they get read. Books like Anna in the Tropics, very good, but they are teaching that in schools. I think that, you know, things that do deal with things that are about immigrants or other cultures are really being, I think they're being pushed, at least in the schools. Julie?
Well, I think sometimes when we talk about Florida literature, we do seem to come back to the same stable of writers who do seem to be more often than not white writers. And why do we never talk about Edwidge Dantacat, who is, I think, the most important writer living in Florida today, and she never gets discussed.
Although she doesn't set most of her work in Florida.
I mean, she is in Florida. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Richard Blanco, he read at Obama's second inauguration. Nilo Cruz, we have talked about. Chantel Acevedo, Amina Gaudier, Diana Abujamra.
Well, Julie, why do you think?
There's a certain thing that people want to focus on, which is the pastoral Florida, which and not say issues of travel and migration and exile. And I think the pastoral Florida tends to overlook other themes.
Yeah, people are going to buy what they enjoy reading, and there's not much you can do about that except in the schools when you can assign things to people. But I think Edwidge Dentecat gets a lot of, I mean, certainly on NPR has gotten a lot of press.
Blanco as well has gotten a lot. Blanco's certainly wonderful, wonderful memoir. Actually did pretty well, sold pretty well, and it's all about the immigrant experience. It's a terrific book.
Yeah.
That's Colette Bancroft, the book editor at the Tampa Bay Times. We're talking about how Florida is used as a setting in some recent fiction. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sussingham, and we're talking about how Florida is portrayed in recent fiction. Our guests are Dr. Julie Armstrong and Dr. Thomas Halleck, English professors at USF St. Petersburg, and Colette Bancroft, the book editor at the Tampa Bay Times. So moving on to the Yanalasi Writing Camp for Girls by Anton de Sclafani. It's set in the 1930s with the Great Depression on the doorstep, and 15-year-old Thea Atwell has done something to make her parents send her away from her idyllic home among the orange groves in central Florida and away from her fraternal twin Sam to an exclusive equestrian boarding school in the mountains of North Carolina. One thing I liked about this book was the way it placed Florida in contrast to the rest of the South. Did that strike anybody else? She talks about what the Memphis girls are like, what the Atlanta girls are like.
Mm-hmm. De Sclafani is definitely a pan-Southern author. I've written some interviews that she has spent quite a bit of time in Texas. That's where some of her family is. She now teaches at Auburn University. She went to Emory in Atlanta, and she was born in North Florida. Mm-hmm. So she is definitely situating Florida within. And the idea of Florida as this paradise lost. The story is not so much what happens, but why. We learn that Thea Atwell has been sent to the riding camp, the finishing school, on the cusp of the Great Depression for a reason that we do not know. And the thing that keeps you moving through the novel is what happens. In fact, I did kind of cheat when I read it because I wanted to know, all right, what's going to happen?
I'm not supposed to do that.
You know, it happened by accident, actually. I picked up the book and I saw the name of a character and I thought, ah, that's the one. But it is Florida is lost. The orange grove that are family owned gets taken away. They have to sell it because of the money. And then also there's a sense of this both eroticism and danger in Florida and that in coming of age stories. Mm-hmm. Florida is a great setting for coming of age stories, all sorts of dangerous yet also alluring.
Going back to the yearling.
I think of Karen Russell's
Swamplandia. Swamplandia.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I can't think of a greater story of sexuality and danger than Their Eyes Were Watching God. Zora Neale Hurston, absolutely. And I think what De Sclafani does with horses is very much what Zora Neale Hurston was doing with the pear tree, the famous pear tree. And with sexual power, particularly for women, comes a certain amount of danger, comes a certain amount of risk, and also comes a certain amount of judgment. And that's one of the more interesting things. De Sclafani is definitely looking at the double standard towards women. I don't want to get too far into the plot, but let's just say that the responsibility for sexual mores falls upon the girl.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I liked about Thea so much in this book was that she didn't really care. I mean, this girl wanted what she wanted, and she was very complicated. She wasn't really a good girl. You know, she could be really selfish and destructive, but likable. I thought she was a very, very complicated character.
In the end, she takes a hit for her friend. In the end, when it matters most and there is a test for her character, she actually puts her future on the line to bail out a friend so the friend can then go on and live the life that she leads.
That she was destined for. Yeah. I wasn't surprised. I thought she was a good person.
Yeah, Thea is actually a good character. She just,
I want to go back to what you said about her setting Florida apart from the rest of the South. And I think she does that at the very beginning when she talks about Thea's family background, that her father's family is defined as old Florida.
Right.
And what that means in their context is he's descended from the Spaniards, and that her mother is New Florida, and for them that means that she moved there from Georgia after the Civil War.
Right.
That's New Florida in this context, and which is a very different notion from what we have today of Old Florida and New Florida. But it sets her it does set Florida apart from the rest of the South in a way that for her mother's family, Florida was a place to flee, you know, the destruction of the Civil War, because it wasn't as hard hit in direct ways as Georgia was. Mm-hmm. And for her father's family, it's the mythic past practically. So I think she does set it apart in a lot of ways from the rest of the South in making Thea this outsider character when she goes to the riding camp with all these girls with the diamond barrettes from places like Memphis.
I want to read this this short passage in the book, which is directly about that, when she's talking to Mr. Holmes, the headmaster, and he says, "You're from the southernmost state. What else would you be if not a southerner?" And she says, "I'm a Floridian, and we're a different breed. Unbound by the rules of society and civilization, a breed apart. We were the only people at the table speaking, and I felt suddenly as if on stage. I was drawing too much attention to myself." Alice Hunt patted the corners of her mouth with a white linen napkin so gently. "I can't speak for everyone from the state," I said lightly, but even as I spoke, my voice sounded cold and serious. "But Florida's a different place. And besides, I don't think we're Southern enough for the rest of the South."
Yeah. This reminds me, and what you were saying before about Florida literature that doesn't deal with themes of travel, themes of race, all of those things. What's really my favorite recent Florida fiction, and that's Peter Matheson's Shadow Country.
Absolutely.
Which sets Florida apart in a similar way, but also deals with all of those things and with Florida's past and Florida's future but that book, I think, deals with all of these themes we're talking about and takes all of them to another level.
Mm-hmm. But it is the one thing is we're talking about capturing the essence and capturing the spirit of Florida, that we like this novel because it really captures the place, but we're not really always capturing the real place. We have to remember that we're capturing not only the place, but also what the place that we wanted to exist back then.
This idea of magical realism, which is in a lot of these novels about Florida,
Swamplandia.
But you know, it's
and so is Fates and Furies to a certain extent.
But almost what's magical realism, if you said it in Iowa, is sort of realism said in Florida.
That's
because
what I mean.
There is so
you
much.
You can really have a mother who's a mermaid in Florida.
You really can. Let's mention Swamplandia, Colette, because you liked that book.
Yeah, I like that book.
That was
a lot.
By Karen Russell. Mm-hmm. Came out a couple years ago.
Right. Karen Russell is a, I believe, fourth generation Floridian who grew up in the Miami area, I think Homestead. Her family's been here, not quite going back to the Spaniards, but for a long time.
Do a brief summary about how Florida's depicted in that book.
Swamplandia is magical realism. Ava Bigtree, the main character, is a young girl whose family runs a theme park conveniently located in the 10,000 Islands, which you can only reach by ferry. And its main attraction that was her mother would dive off a platform into a pool of, I believe it's 92 alligators, and swim through the alligators and every night survive. But at the beginning of the book, she dies, not because of the alligators. She dies of cancer. And the family, Ava and her brother and sister and her father, fall apart. And the book is about what happens to them. And her brother, Kiwi, goes to work at a new theme park that has opened right off the interstate nearby on the west coast of Florida called World of Darkness. And it's a theme park in which you essentially go to hell, and that's the experience.
That's when you ride down the tongue.
You ride down the tongue. You can have Dante's tamales for lunch and things like that. And
but you have to pay.
But you have to pay, exactly.
Willingly.
But you know, if you've paid to go to a theme park and realized you've spent $100 to spend most of the day standing in line, it's not an outlandish idea that you would pay to go to hell. So Ava is trying to find herself, find her family, put her family back together one by one. They leave. Her father goes off on a business trip. Kiwi goes to hell. Her sister starts dating ghosts. And Ava goes on this quest into the Everglades. She's the only character in these books that we're talking about who doesn't leave Florida, who doesn't leave paradise. Well, she does. Swamplandia is kind of her paradise, taking with her a little red alligator, which is one of my favorite things in the book, that red alligator. And she goes looking for herself in the depths of the Everglades and finds something she really didn't expect. But it's one of my favorite Florida books.
I agree with you, Nicola, completely. It's just a beautiful, beautiful mm-hmm. book. It's mm-hmm. actually been a fantastic novel to read in literature classes. Mm-hmm.
Would it offer outsiders an insight into Florida culture at all?
Oh, absolutely, because and almost everything in the book, in the beginning of the book, is some sort of facade. I said jokingly, and half jokingly a few minutes ago, Florida is essentially fiction. Well, that's part of what Swamplandia is about. The Big Tree family, Ava's family, you know, in running this theme park, they present themselves as Native Americans, and they're not. You know, her grandfather made that whole thing up. And so everything about them is sort of theme park. You know, that's not just their business, that's what they are.
Well, this idea, even in Peter Matheson, of
inventing yourself,
coming to Florida
exactly.
and reinventing
yes.
yourself.
Yes, and then reinventing mm-hmm. as you need to. And also, another thing Swamplandia has in common with Shadow Country is that idea of taking that Edenic landscape and exploiting the heck out of it. And selling it to the tourists, you know, diving into the gator pond.
Selling them back their birthright.
Exactly.
As we get back to the beginning. We are out of time, unfortunately. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Julie Armstrong and Dr. Thomas Halleck, English professors at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg, and Colette Bancroft, the Tampa Bay Times book editor. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
It has been an absolute pleasure.
It has. It's been delightful.
You can find a list of the books we've discussed on our website, WUSF.org. Just click on Florida Matters. Let us know what you think on our Facebook page, or tweet us at WUSF, or email us at floridamatters@wusf.org. Our engineer is Richard Jimenez. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.